This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Slavery is a word that most of us read in history books. If it exists today at all, we think, it must be in some benighted part of the world very far away. This month, though, National Geographic magazine, in text and photographs, shows its readers that slavery is much more prevalent and much closer than we think, and as malevolent as ever. If you have questions about where slavery is most prevalent, how many people worldwide are slaves, and what can be done about it, give us a phone call or send us an email. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the reporter and photographer who traveled the world to report the story of 21st century slavery. But first, to help give our conversation some terms and numbers to work with, we turn to John Miller. He's Director of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking and Persons at the U.S. State Department. He joins us by phone from his office in Washington, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
What is the State Department's definition of slavery?
Well, slavery is when people are forced against their will to do things, whether it's forced labor or sex slavery or child impressment into the military or camel jockey slavery or slavery based on race and religion. The key element is forcing somebody, whether by physical means or psychological means or other means, against their will to do something they don't want to do. And it's a situation generally where the person really cannot escape.
Give us a sense of the numbers. You monitor trafficking in persons. How many people are trafficked internationally?
Well, one thing one has to understand is there are estimates all over the map. And it's very difficult to estimate, Neil, because the victims whose souls and bodies are being ruined just don't stand up to be counted as in a census. So you have a U.S. government estimate of 800,000 to 900,000 people trafficked across international borders annually into slavery, including 18,000 to 20,000 in the United States. You have much higher estimates. National Geographic uses an estimate from Kevin Bale's book, Disposable People, of 27 million that includes large numbers of bonded laborers in countries like India and Pakistan and Nepal. The truth is, while we don't know the exact figure, we know it's too many, that slavery, particularly sex slavery, reaches into almost every country of the world.
What is the United States doing to fight this?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, the Congress in 2000 passed a law that established some very severe penalties for slave trading or trafficking in persons that provided assistance for victims that come into this country, assistance that had been available for refugees, even including temporary residents while they cooperate in prosecutions, maybe even the possibility of permanent residents, provided some limited funds to help programs around the world and in the United States. President Bush last December signed an executive order asking every agency of the government to come up with a strategic implementation plan and how they were going to contribute to this struggle. One of the things the United States does is the annual State Department report, where we evaluate how countries around the world are doing. And this year, if they're not doing very well, they face the possibility of a loss of some kinds of U.S. aid. In addition, just a couple of weeks ago, the Justice Department did an assessment of how the United States is doing. So those are some of the things going on. This is a struggle that has been, Neil, beneath the radar for the news media. This is why it's so important, and I'm so delighted that National Geographic has spotlighted this issue, because it's an issue that so many more people have to become aware of if we're going to move the governments of the world that are awakening to this issue, but if we're going to move them to take all the steps that are necessary to abolish slavery.
You say they're awakening to the issue, yet by the numbers, there are any numbers of governments who are clearly looking the other way. Is maybe the threat of the loss of a little bit of aid, couldn't more be done?
Well, that's basically the stick that we have. Of course, back in the 19th century, the Great Britain used a bigger stick against slave trade. At that time, they sent out the British Navy to stop the slave trade and freed hundreds of thousands of slaves. I don't think that tool is available to us at the moment, but there's a lot we can do. And I would say that while we're becoming aware of the immensity of this challenge, I wouldn't say the picture is all bleak. If you look around the world, even the last 6 months, as this report was about to come out and countries were afraid of the shame of being poorly rated, we saw for the first time a lot of significant efforts. We saw countries from the Philippines to Haiti to Burkina Faso to Georgia passing anti-trafficking laws. We saw massive arrests of traffickers from Serbia to Cambodia. So there are some positive developments, and yet, so much more needs to be done.
John Miller, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Miller is the Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State on Trafficking in Persons and the Director of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking. He was on the line with us from his office at the State Department. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Jody Cobb, who photographed 21st century slaves for the September National Geographic magazine. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Jody, let's jump right in and talk about a picture of of yours. For those with a computer, if you're listening, you can head to Talk of the Nation's webpage at www.npr.org to take a look at the photo we're talking about. If you have a copy of the magazine nearby, it's the one with the zebras on the cover. We're looking at a photo that covers pages 6 and 7, and it's a beautiful, almost a sensuous scene. Cobalt blue sky, a luscious oranges and browns saturated with light. If you look a little more closely, you'll see women with handmade bricks stacked as high as they are on their heads. Who are these women?
They're the workers in the brick kiln in India, where a large number of bonded laborers are employed and forced into the work, sometimes for generations. Sometimes the debts that they get into are passed down from through the generations to their children.
Were you able to talk with any of them?
I mostly was photographing. Mm-hmm. It was just such a horrendous scene, and the light was going fast, and I had to work very quickly because they were almost finished for the day.
You say they're debt slaves, effectively. How did they wind up that way?
Well, the kill owners will lend money to a family for some large expense, like a funeral or a wedding, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So that they run up these debts, and then they have to pay them off by working.
Yes, they put the whole family into bondage and never do get the debt paid off.
How many debt slaves like this are there in India, do you think?
Well, there are apparently millions. I know some industries are completely run by debt labor.
It's an extraordinary photograph, and it's just one. There is some extraordinary text that accompanies this this article. Joining us now is Andrew Coburn, a National Geographic writer who also worked on this story. He's also here in Studio 3A. Very nice of you to come in.
Nice to be here.
You start your article by focusing on a differently structured sort of slavery. You started in the Balkans. Tell us the scene.
Well, the scene was at the headquarters of a fellow who's actually a very notorious slave trafficker in the Balkans, a guy called Milorad Milakovic, who is very much feared in that part of the world. He's a major mafioso, a gangster, and he traffics in women, among other things. He has a large number of brothels, nightclubs slash brothels, where girls are forced to work, are forced to be sex workers, kept in very bad conditions. And, you know, I thought one of the more shameful aspects of his business was it has flourished off the back of the international community, because a major part of his clientele were the peacekeepers and, you know, international policemen who were sent into Bosnia after the end of the Bosnian War to keep the peace there.
How is it that these women cannot escape?
Well, because they get beaten to a pulp if they try, and they're locked in. I mean, they are slaves, you know. They're kept both, well, I should elaborate, I shouldn't be too flippant about it. First of all, they are physically confined. I mean, they can't get away. But there's also, there's, you know, and time and again, I came across cases and heard about cases and talking to people of psychological dependence. I mean, these women have been cut off from their own, you know, they've come into this life, they're forced into this degrading existence. And in the end, every so often, the slave master, or the pimp, or whatever you want to call him, becomes like, you know, their one friend. And there have been cases, not that many, but there are cases of women who have been freed who go back, you know, voluntarily return to their servitude.
You describe this extraordinary scene of having lunch with this man next to his swimming pool, and he's not trying to deny what he does. I mean,
he was rather pleased with this, pleased with his existence. He has said on occasion, he said, what's wrong with selling women? They sell footballers, don't they? I mean, he was being all making nice with me, but he, you know, that's, I'll give you a little example. I mean, one telling thing was I couldn't find a single person who lived within 100, a translator or interpreter, anyone to translate for me, within 100 miles. They were all, when they heard where I wanted to go, they were all too scared of him. Both of him and his menagerie of pet Siberian tigers, because the local legend is he feeds people to the tigers.
And, of course, this happens in many other places than the Balkans. One of the extraordinary pictures, again, in the National Geographic, is of women on a road in India who have I think, if I remember correctly, they're anticipated... lifespan is 40 years, you said.
Right, yes. They are trafficked in for the most part. And they figure that there's about 50,000 of them working there in Mumbai alone. And half of those are trafficked in from Nepal.
Let's take a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Gary joins us on the line from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, Neil, this is a fascinating show.
Thank you.
You know, I heard you mention that there is slavery in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's comforting to know as an American that it is against the laws of the United States that this slavery exists, and hopefully the authorities are going after this institution in the United States. My question is, are all the countries around the world, are they united in terms of their laws? What is written on the books, is it technically against the law to have and own slaves around the world?
Andrew Coburn?
Well, we have in the issue, the article we're talking about, there's a little table which says the number of countries in which slavery is legal, zero, and then there's a long, long, long list of all the countries where at least 100 people were trafficked in the last year. So, including in this country, it is comforting to know that slavery is against the law in this country, and yet we found that slavery exists here, and it's very much a part of the modern economy. You know, there's a good chance.
May I ask how much prosecution in the United States has taken place on this issue?
There are prosecutions, especially since the passing of the 2000 Traffic in Persons Act. But it's easier now to get evidence because the people who want to testify don't automatically get deported, which is what happened before. So there are prosecutions, and there is an awareness in law enforcement, you know, about this, and yet it's not a top priority. It's, you know, people, I think it's part of the problem is people still find it hard to grasp, but this is like a, you know, a big problem. You know, everyone knows, like, there's a drug trade and you crack down on drug trafficking, but slave trading still sounds weird in the 21st century.
Gary, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
We're discussing the worldwide traffic in human beings. That's right, slavery. And we're taking more of your calls after a short break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing 21st century slavery If you haven't already, you can see two of the photographs from the National Geographic article we're discussing on our website. Head to www.npr.org and find the Talk of the Nation page. If you'd like to join our discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Our guests are Jody Cobb, a National Geographic photographer, and Andrew Coburn, a writer with National Geographic magazine. Together, they document the story of slavery around the world in the September 2003 story, 21st Century Slaves. Let's go to another caller, and Salek joins us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you, Neil. My name is Salek El-Mustafa, and I'm from Mauritania. I want to confirm that there is slavery still in Mauritania. If we go by the definition, we have all kind of slave in Mauritania now. It's right that it's illegal, but they still have a slavery anywhere in Mauritania and even in the capital, Nouakchott.
How do you know it exists?
I was there, and my grandmother was a slave, too. I live right now in the United States, but I live all my life in Mauritania, and I'm 30 years old, and I've been seen a lot of kind of a slave in Mauritania. If you go by definition, you can say all kind of slave in Mauritania is still there, and the government can't do anything. They just apply with the slavery, the question of slavery, if they have an election matter or something like that. But they're not willing to do anything against this. And I think the one thing is working with to see more slavery in Mauritania is the religion. Because the Muslim people think that the religion allowed him to have a slave and someone can stand at front of the judge or the president and say, "This is my slave."
Well,
say that.
Salek, thanks for the call. I wish we could say that it was just one group of people or one ethnic group or one race or one religion that was involved in slavery. It is not. It is, as documented in this story, many people from all around the world. Andrew Coburn, I'm not sure you got to Mauritania, but certainly Africa is a terrible problem.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there is a lot of... Mauritania is an example of, in a way, of sort of traditional slavery. I mean, there's always been slavery there. It's, you know, it's the government sort of periodically protests that it's abolished it, but of course, as the caller made clear, it still goes on. In West Africa, recently, there's been a scandal of enslaved children having to work in the cocoa plantations. Although I should say, that's in a way a hopeful sign. There was such an uproar about that the international sort of chocolate industry actually got together and decreed, started to enforce certain conditions for the cocoa plantations there, which actually have had the effect of cutting back slavery there. So it's an example of what can be done when the people who profit from slavery or indirectly actually take a stand against it.
An email we've got from Patricia, she writes, "It's very difficult for Americans to understand the fear of not having your identity documents. In most countries, especially in Eastern Europe, your documents are critical. When those are taken away, you feel powerless and paralyzed. Then you do not speak the local language. You feel it's impossible to ask for help. No documents, no language. You're a slave." Jody, does that sound familiar?
Yes, that sounds very familiar. That's the situation that most of the women get into that are trafficked today. And that's one of the forms of torture and coercion that the traffickers use against these girls. And if they escape, they have no documentation. And then the result of that is that they are often deported. They become victimized a second time. Hmm. They aren't allowed to stay in the country. And they're sent back to a very dubious future from where they came from in the first place.
And presumably not welcomed with open arms either.
No, really not. And sometimes also in danger again of being trafficked by the same people who trafficked them from their villages and their towns in the very first place.
Let's get another caller. Mark is on the line from Naples, Florida.
Yes, first time, long time. I'm trying to put things in perspective for myself. I'm trying to find out the difference between indentured servants as in early America versus bonded slavery.
Andrew Coburn, many people came to this country in the early days of colonial America as indentured servants, usually for a term of 7 years, as I recall.
Right, well, during which time they were slaves, actually. But, I mean, the fact that there might be a time limit on your period of slavery doesn't make you... It's slightly better, I guess, than having an indefinite sentence, but it still makes you a slave. The fact is, however, as Jody was mentioning earlier, talking about these Indian bonded slaves, I mean, it goes on. That's a life sentence. I mean, it goes on, you know, over several generations. And we certainly came across cases here in this country where people were, you know, they were bonded slaves, but the bond, you know, the bond never gets paid off. It's structured in such a way as every time, you know, you've had a meal or whatever, that's added to your debt, so you never succeed in paying it all.
One of the most chilling descriptions of this that you give is of Mexican peasants who are smuggled across the border by coyotes, and in order to pay off the smuggling debt, they are sold into the coyote, in order to recover the smuggling debt, sells them off into slavery.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's why I call this a very modern problem. This is not people talk about this ancient practice. In a way, slavery is very modern because it's a reflection of poor people, you know, wanting to get to rich countries. Rich countries want poor people to work cheaply inside the borders. But to get into the rich country, you have to pay a smuggler. You can't do it freelance anymore. Certainly to get into this country, you have to pay a smuggler, a coyote, and you end up in debt to him. And that... not always, but in a large number of cases, you know, means you end up being enslaved. It's a function of border control, if you like.
Email question from Michael Hobbs in Chapel Hill. I live in North Carolina, where textile industry jobs are disappearing and going to countries such as those being discussed on this program. Can your guest comment on whether any goods being produced with slave labor are being exported to the West? Jody?
Oh, yes, very much. So in the carpet belt of India, where there are probably 300,000 young children held against their will and often kidnapped and taken from their parents working on the carpet looms. And they figure that maybe one figure I heard was $140 million worth of carpets imported into the U.S. every year.
Another picture you have is of leather workers in Italy.
The handbags would be stamped made in Italy, but they're often made by people who are held in slave conditions.
Let's go.
Mostly Chinese in that area of Italy.
But it's desperate people that you write about, Andrew Coburn, and that your pictures are taken of people desperate to flee the conditions under which they live, which makes them vulnerable once they have moved away from their homes.
That's right. I mean, we're talking vulnerable people. I mean, they are the raw material for the modern slave economy. And in fact, you get cases where, you know, there are Indian children who have been kidnapped who have been trafficked to Nepal, and Nepalese children who are trafficked to India. You know, it's people dislocated from their homes, from their cultures, whether willingly because they wanted to flee starvation or desperate conditions, or kidnapped, as happens with children in India quite frequently. It is, you know, this the world, there are billions of, or hundreds of millions of vulnerable people in the world, and they are the raw material for the modern slave economy.
Let's get another caller, and Chester's with us from Minneapolis.
Hello, my name's Chester. I'm just calling to cite an example where there is slave labor, specifically in the United States. In Immokalee, Florida, there's a company, 6L, that I think the guest you have on your show mentioned how they smuggle immigrants in and force them into slave labor. This company, 6L, has been doing this for many years now, and it's basically to pick tomatoes.
I'm not sure about the company, Chester. Andrew Coburn, you were in Immokalee.
Right, well, we both were. But 6L's actually, no, 6L's is a growing company. It's not, no one's ever accused them of smuggling in slaves.
Well, they don't smuggle them in. Someone else smuggles them in, and they work at 6L to pay off their debt.
Well, to be precise, actually, there have been cases of people working for companies, crew bosses, are contracted by companies like 6L's to pick their crops. I mean, I see what you're getting at, but you have to be careful. I don't think no one's ever accused 6L's themselves of actually owning slaves.
Yet, if people hire subcontractors who do own slaves, Well, shouldn't they know or should have known? I mean, you'd think a lawyer would be able to make a killing off of this.
Well, certainly there was a case we talk about in the piece where there was some crew bosses were convicted recently of actually in the citrus industry in Florida of hiring, of keeping slaves. There were people, a family called Ramos in Lake Placid, Florida. And they had a large number of people under confinement, actually right next to between a retirement community and a Ramada Inn. But they were caught. The federal agents arrested them, and they were tried and convicted. And the judge, in his summing up, I mean, in his final remarks, said he would not exempt corporations in the inn. You know, it wasn't just these people, the people actually convicted in the standing in the dock, but the corporations that contracted them also bore responsibility for this. So, you know, it's exactly right. It's people who profit off this system who are equally culpable.
And it is highly profitable. Jody, I wanted to ask you about one more picture in National Geographic's article on 21st century slavery, a picture of a baby in a box.
Mm.
Tell me about it.
Oh, that was in Guatemala, and I was taken by an aid organization there to a small market where two women were sitting side by side. One was very pregnant, and the other, her sister, had just had this baby. And apparently the sister had sold two of her babies into an illegal adoption situation. And this child was terribly at risk, and the outreach workers were going there a couple times a week to check on that child and make sure that that it was okay and that it wasn't going to be caught in the adoption issue that Guatemala is having some problems with.
The future of this baby is going to be difficult, isn't it?
That baby's going to have a hard time, as they say in the article, that half the people in the world live on less than $2 a day. And it's sort of this incredible poverty that puts people at risk. And there's always people now, and it seems to be a growing group of people, who are willing to exploit those people for their own personal gain.
Thank you both for this eye-opening and jaw-dropping article. It's well worth reading. Again, you can see a couple of Jody's pictures on our website at www.npr.org, and the full story is in the September issue of National Geographic, the one with the zebras on the cover. With us here in Studio 3A, Andrew Coburn, thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And, of course, Jody Smith, we appreciate your time as well. Jody Cobb, excuse me.
That's okay. Thank you.
I do apologize. We're discussing the issue of slavery in 21st century world, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from National Public Radio News. With us now from the airport in Memphis, Tennessee, is Kevin Bales, director of Free the Slaves, which is based here in Washington, D.C. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Neil, thank you so much for having me.
National Geographic's piece included a page headed, I Was Born a Slave. It's the narrative of a woman named Salma who was born into slavery in Mauritania, as were generations before her. She says in her own words, when I got to the U.S., I worked braiding hair. The first time I was paid for work I had done, I cried. I had never seen a person paid for work before in my life. It was a very good surprise. How did Salma get out of slavery?
You know, Salma did something of incredible bravery, which was to take the decision to flee the slavery on the farm where she was being held in southern Mauritania, and to, in fact, leave her own children. She came to the decision that she would never get her own children out of slavery until she got herself out of slavery. So she fled in the night, crossed the Senegal River into Senegal, met up with Mauritanians there, and began the process of both getting herself to the United States and getting her own children out of slavery.
How do most people get out?
Well, most people, sad to say today, are often come out of slavery because they're dumped by the people who are holding them. Slaves today are at an all-time low in price. Slaves are cheaper today than they've ever been. And that means that they are rarely cared for by the people who hold them, their masters. And it often means that a great number of people who are in slavery come out because They're simply worn out, broken down, used up, and then disposed of.
You say they're relatively cheap. One of the calculations in the Geographic article was that in the what we think of as slavery, 18th century, slaves were about $40,000 each. What do they cost today?
Well, in 2 years ago in West Africa, we were able to go into a market and buy the equivalent of, say, a pre-Civil War slave in America, a 19-year-old young male, healthy agricultural worker for $40.
$40?
$40 for the complete productive capacity of a human being. And when you think about that, what you're buying for $40, it really is a remarkable bargain and a horrific comment on the disposability of those slaves today.
Salma also wrote about not feeling safe even in the United States. How long does it take to overcome that psychological barrier?
Well, it varies dramatically for different slaves. I have a friend who is an ex-slave who is now a teacher, and he's been out of slavery for some 30 years. He was a child slave in Haiti, and he's achieved great things. He's a published author. He runs his own charity. But when he stands up to talk about his own experience, he tells me he's still filled with shame and a kind of fear because of the experiences of his childhood being abused in slavery. Others, like Salma, and I have to say I have a good report from Salma from last week, who's now working in a donut shop, who's now supporting herself and buying her own apartment. I think for Salma, the sense of fear is passing or almost passed.
Did she get her children out?
Yes, her children are out now. One daughter is with her in Cincinnati, where she now lives, and the others are out of slavery in Mauritania, but are in Senegal waiting to come to the United States.
Well, that's a positive. Does everybody that we've been classifying as slaves, do they see themselves as slaves? Do they think of themselves as slaves?
Well, I have to say sometimes yes and sometimes no. Certainly people that I have met who are enslaved, for example, in hereditary forms of slavery in Mauritania or the kind of hereditary slavery that occurs in India through debt bondage, they grow up in a context where their family has always belonged to another family. There is no other world for them but to be a person who always works for someone else. And they don't necessarily stop to think, oh, yes, I'm enslaved. Oh, yes, I have a set of rights which are being violated. Those rights have never been made explicit to them. And the result, of course, is that it takes some time and hopefully an exposure to those ideas to let them see the potential of freedom in their lives.
Kevin Bales, thank you so much.
You bet.
Kevin Bales joined us after a flight to Memphis, Tennessee. He's the director of Free the Slaves here in Washington. For more information about the global prevalence of slavery, you can head to our website, www.npr.org. Find the Talk of the Nation webpage.